Welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And this episode, our subject is Heath Ledger and his final film, Terry Gilliam's The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. And joining me to talk about this film is my pal and fellow network all-star, Max Romero. Hi, Max.
Hey, Rob.
I am happy to have you here on Fade Out.
I am happy to be here. This is such a great idea. I love it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, this is, in terms of the context of Fade Out, examining actors' final films, this is probably, this is every filmmaker's nightmare scenario in that the actor, again, in this case, Heath Ledger, passes away in the middle of production, which, again, we don't want to slight the tragedy of this very talented young man dying so young, but on a pure practical level, as for a filmmaker, you could not have anything worse happen than an actor passing away at this point in the film. I think what I had read that Ledger had shot 1/3 of his part before he died on January 22nd, and it was just the worst thing imaginable. And I can remember hearing about that when the news breaking that he had passed away, and I remember thinking I'm like, that's got to be wrong, right? He's a young guy. That can't possibly have been the case. And then we find out that that is exactly what happened. I mean, so when did you first discover Heath Ledger? Like, what film was he in that he really popped for you?
Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and blame my mom for this. where I discovered Heath Ledger actually was in A Knight's Tale.
Okay.
2001, and it's a very silly, lighthearted, extremely charming movie. Mm-hmm. my mom loves that movie. And one time I went over to her house to go see it. I mean, not to go see it, to go see her. And
Freudian slip there, Max.
Yeah, Freudian slip. And my mom and I, one of the things that has marked our relationship is movies. We have watched movies together for as long as I can remember, including movies I wouldn't necessarily want to watch on my own. I've seen a lot of rom-coms and stuff like that because of my mom.
And, you're a good son, Max.
She had one of the cable services, and A Knight's Tale was about to start, and she was very excited about it because she had already seen it and she wanted me to see it. And that was my introduction to Heath Ledger. And I think I had probably heard the name, but hadn't really paid attention to it. But he, not unlike the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, he is at the core of that movie. And he is able to carry it. And for being such a young actor who is essentially at the beginning of his career, really, it's pretty remarkable what he's able to pull off. And, of course, he became famous for The Dark Knight, and which was a complete transformation. And that was the movie that really, Brokeback Mountain, of course, which is another one of his movies, Monstrous Ball, something that I really respect about certain actors and something I respect about Heath Ledger is when they make interesting choices. Mm-hmm. And choices that aren't necessarily, I mean, it would have been very easy for Heath Ledger to just make movies that were fluff and kind of just rested on his good looks,
right?
Not have to try too hard. But he didn't do that, And if you look at the movies he did make, they were all demanding of him as an actor, and he always came through. And I think, A Knight's Tale is not necessarily where you're going to see that, but it was a good introduction to Heath Ledger. It bought him a lot of goodwill on my part.
I have not seen A Knight's Tale. He was only 22 when he made that. My favorite story about A Knight's Tale was an interview I read about Heath Ledger. I guess it had to have been probably a couple of years later after he really got huge and did Brokeback Mountain and stuff. And there was the poster for A Knight's Tale is just a big close up of his handsome face. That's it. There's no cover. There's no poster design here. It's just a giant picture of his face with the logo of the movie and the tagline, "He will rock you," which is absolutely abysmal tagline. But what I laugh about that is in the interview, he talked about seeing the poster for the first time and not knowing that that was going to be the tagline. And so he sees this poster and his face and he's mortified. He is just mortified that that's the tagline. And he said for years afterwards, some of his closest friends to goof on him would call him and leave a message and just go, "He will rock you," and hang on. And I thought, okay, I like this guy. He's got a real sense of humor about himself. Because as you said, he could have just he had only done a couple of movies before that. He did 10 Things I Hate About You, mm-hmm. which was the, you know, the teen rom-com version of Taming of the Shrew. He did something right. called Two Hands, which I haven't seen, and then The Patriot with Mel Gibson, and then A Knight's Tale. And it's like, he clearly, as you just said, could have done A Knight's Tale 2, A Knight's Tale 3, mm-hmm. you know, not literally, but that kind of thing of just handsome guy, just play up that. And then if you look at his movies starting immediately after that, as you said, they become very interesting. He's in Monster's Ball, The Four Feathers, which, you know, a new version of that story, Ned Kelly, Lords of Dogtown. Mm-hmm. Then he's working with Terry Gilliam, which you will hear again, and The Brothers Grimm, Brokeback Mountain, which was, you know, that's a, it's hard for people younger than a certain age to think that leading men starring as gay men was a risky mm-hmm. career move.
Right.
Because now it's not. Now it's just, you don't even notice it. But in 2005, that was still pretty controversial. And I can imagine that Jake Gyllenhaal and especially up-and-comer Heath Ledger, I can guess that their agents, there might have been one or two of their agents are like, "Do you really need to do this?" Mm-hmm. And they broke that. They broke that mold because after that, it stopped becoming really controversial. And I right. thought, wow, that takes real guts to put everything on the line kind of like that for your career. And then he did Casanova, a film called Candy. He went on to star as one of the six Bob Dylans in I'm Not There, which makes this the second episode in a row of Fade Out where I've mentioned Bob Dylan. And then he went on to do The Dark Knight, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And then, of course, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. So let's pause here for a moment, and let me talk to you about Terry Gilliam. Where are you as a Terry Gilliam fan? Are you a big fan of his films?
You know, I love Terry Gilliam unreservedly. He okay. he doesn't always hit the mark, and we'll talk about that a little later with this, mm-hmm. with this movie. But he, I think he's probably one of my favorite directors just because there is no one else like Terry Gilliam. A Terry Gilliam movie is a fingerprint. There is no mistaking his movies for anyone else. His themes, he's always very committed to his theme, anti-authoritarianism, of the power of imagination and storytelling, which is, you know, very much upfront here, obviously.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You know, these are things that he has brought over with him from his time with Monty Python when he was doing the animations and as a sometimes cast member. And, you know, so when you see God's thumb or the giant foot come down and like, you know, on anyone, you know, that is Terry Gilliam in every movie he's ever done. And, if nothing else, I will always owe a debt to Terry Gilliam for introducing me to Uma Thurman.
Thanks, Terry.
Yeah, exactly. Uma Thurman on the half shell in
Baron Munchausen.
The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. You know, that was, you know, I fell in love with that movie instantly. And, you know, of course, I had already seen Brazil and, you know, some of his other work. But I think that his sense of dark whimsy, if I can.
I was literally, I was going to say grim whimsy, which is yeah. grimsy, I guess, but grimsy. Yeah,
I
was thinking
about that. Yeah. I like that grimsy. His, yeah, that aesthetic, I think is really interesting and not to everyone's taste, but, very much to mine.
Fair enough. I certainly saw, I was familiar with Monty Python as a kid. I remember my dad taking me to see Time Bandits. That was a big one. We will talk about this as we go on. But one of the things about Terry Gilliam that I simultaneously admire and find frustrating is that I feel like every one of his movies is like 50 pounds of ideas in a 40-pound mm-hmm. bag. It is, yeah. just, you know, and to me, his best films are the ones where he's able to kind of get a good grip on all the concepts he's throwing out in his films. And then the weaker ones are ones where I think he lets go with the reins a little, or the reins just get away from him. Mm-hmm. And I, even as I say that, I feel a little churlish about complaining that somebody has too many ideas in their movie, because there are so many movies out there that have virtually no ideas. You know, not a one. You know what I mean? So it's like, how can I complain that a guy is overstuffing his films with concepts? Well, okay. Maybe it's a little disorienting. And again, we'll talk about that, because I think that that word comes into play here for Imaginarium. I do want to get into the plot a little in the cast. It was released on January 8th, 2010. As I said, it is it was Heath Ledger's final film. Dark Knight is his last completed film, but this was his last film that he appears in. The plot, if you can describe it as such, is the film follows a traveling theater troupe whose leader, the titular Dr. Parnassus, Christopher Plummer, having made a bet with the devil, played by, of course, Tom Waits, takes audience members through a magical mirror to explore their imaginations and present them with a choice between self-fulfilling enlightenment or gratifying ignorance. On their journey, the troupe stumbles upon Tony, Heath Ledger, an amnesiac who they find hanging by his neck off a bridge. They save Tony's life, and he quickly becomes part of the troupe, proving to be a more compelling salesman than Anton, Andrew Garfield. Tony takes different audience members who see him in different forms, each corresponding to their utmost inner desires. The bet between Parnassus and Mr. Nick, a.k.a. the devil, becomes more dire when it is revealed that Parnassus made another ill-informed deal with him years ago, which would give Parnassus the love of his life, but in return, any children from that union would become property of the devil upon their 16th birthday. Parnassus's daughter, Valentina, played by Lily Cole, is just 3 days away from turning 16. The cast, as I mentioned, is Heath Ledger plays Tony, Christopher Plummer is Dr. Parnassus, Lily Cole, Valentina, Andrew Garfield, Anton, Vern Troyer is Percy, Tom Waits is Mr. Nick, and then playing the alternate Tonys, 1, 2, and 3, are in order, Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell. And again, we'll get into all the reasons of why that had to happen shortly. But okay, so I had never seen this film until we decided to talk about it for this episode. I don't know why, because I like Terry Gilliam generally. But this film just, I don't know, it just completely flew under the radar, even though I had heard of the story about why the different actors were cast in it. I don't know why I never got around to it, because like, as we were talking about, I generally like Terry Gilliam's movies. Some of his favorites of mine, I love The Fisher King. I think that's a terrific movie. Again, Time Bandits and 12 Monkeys. I think the ones where he gets a greater grip on what he's trying to present are his most effective. I will say, when I first watched this movie for the first time, and they come out and they wheel out the set, you know, the set on the back of the truck, and this drunken lout climbs up on stage and starts pawing at Valentina, and they drag him in through the mirror, and then all of a sudden we're in this alternate land. I was like, okay, all right, this thing is clearly, you know, the mirror is clearly a portal to another land. I got it. But then when the guy looks into the pond and sees a different face. Mm-hmm. That I was like, wait a minute, what in the hell? And then that hand comes flying by and pulls him up into this crazy sky world with like all these sort of jellyfish that are in the sky. And all of a sudden they're floating above the earth. I was like, oh my God, Terry Gilliam has already kind of lost me. And we're like 5 minutes into this movie. Oh my Lord.
Well, you know, it's like you were saying about too many ideas. And I think, let me digress to a brief story that'll illustrate my point. So when I was young, my sister and I my mom was working and my dad was working nights. So he was asleep during the day. And so we were pretty much alone all summer. Right. And one day we decided that I was going to make a Dagwood sandwich.
Okay. As kids do. Yeah.
As kids do. And so we basically used whatever was in the fridge and just slapped it onto this, you know, quote unquote sandwich.
Oh Lord.
And it was full of things that we liked individually,
right, sure.
But not necessarily all thrown together. And we ended up throwing away a lot of food. But anyway, but my point is that, yeah, sometimes when a writer or a director has too many ideas, you lose the flavor of what it is that you're trying to present. And it becomes a mess. And I don't think the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus quite gets to that point, but it comes close.
Yeah, I could argue. I mean, I didn't even in my plot synopsis. Again, I struggled to write a plot synopsis for this movie because, good Lord, you know, it's so complex. I mean, if you read the plot synopsis on IMDb, it's one line. A traveling theater company gives its audience much more than they were expecting. Well, okay. I guess you can't write stuff happens. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess you can't get away with that. So you got, but I mean, boy, that is minimalist, you wouldn't believe.
It's a lot. It's this movie is a lot. I mean, there's no denying that. And you really, I mean, for some reason, I did not see this when it came to theaters. And I don't know. I think maybe the visual of it left me a little cold. Mm. And we can talk about more about that also. And also, I think it just looking at it, I don't think you can, you know, if you're looking at a trailer or anything like that, you wouldn't know what the hell it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, of course you're not going to have any interest in it. And, I had watched it once before and thought, well, okay. and it does benefit from another viewing, especially if you're really paying hyper attention to it. And you could argue that you shouldn't have to pay that much attention to a movie. But I think I wouldn't put this even in my top 10 Terry Gilliam movies, maybe. But it is an interesting movie. And it does have some interesting ideas. And I think it does have some good performances. You know, Ledger among those. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I didn't even get into the idea that this Parnassus guy is sort of some sort of weird him along with these other guys are these sort of guardians of the universe kind of thing through their storytelling. That's a whole angle that is that, man, Gilliam just brushes by. Yeah. Like, it's the easiest thing in the world to understand. And you're like, wait a minute. All of a sudden, we're in this weird monk-like cavern where Parnassus and these other guys are reading stories. And I guess the idea is the simple act of storytelling is what keeps the universe going. Is that mm-hmm. – that's – I mean, is that – and then the Mr. Nick / the devil character, again, played by perfectly by Tom Waits, by the way. I mean, for a guy who's not really an actor – man, is he fun in movies. I'm a fan of his music,
perfect,
but...
Yeah, is there more perfect casting?
Oh, man, him with his black bowler hat and his pencil-thin mustache and his cigarette holder he stole from the Penguin.
That voice.
Oh, man, yeah, that voice, that gravelly voice, yeah. I mean, oh, my... And, like, and then, you know, that scene of Mr. Nick showing up, because then he ends up turning it around on the others in the room and, like, turns all their mouths into, like, buttholes or something. It was like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, they kind of pucker up. Well, yeah. See, and that's the thing is because, and like you said, you know, Gilliam kind of just brushes over that, which is not doing
that's a whole movie. That's a whole separate movie.
Yeah, well, and the whole movie hinges on that.
Yeah.
Because that's where that lays out the whole idea of storytelling, you know, being a magical force and the bet, you know, it all comes from there. And yeah, so they're yogis, I guess, in some sort of mountain. They're like in a cave. And they're all just kind of muttering and telling stories. And they belong to a sect that believes that, stories are what keep the universe going. And they have to keep telling stories or the universe will disappear or collapse or whatever. And when Mr. Nick basically puckers everyone up, and they can't tell, and so they can't speak. So they stop telling stories and nothing happens. And so Mr. Nick kind of, I think the devil is representing, lack of imagination and a certain, modernity. And also kind of a pragmatism or a practicality that doesn't have room for imagination.
Hmm.
And so and that's why he's in opposition to Dr. Parnassus, who is the only one he does not pucker up like that.
Right.
And as soon as he does that, you know, nothing happens. The world doesn't end and all this stuff. And Mr. Nick says, well, you know, that proves my point. And Dr. Parnassus says, no, someone somewhere is telling a story. Someone is always telling a story, and this is supposed to be a big revelation for him. But like you said, that's just kind of brushed over, and there's no real. I mean, I guess he is kind of freed from from this monastic life. And that's why he's able to leave the retreat, and he's able to go out and have, and, you know, get a wife eventually. And, but none of that is explained, you know, it's just kind of mentioned in passing. And apparently he's thousands of years old.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh man.
And Vern Troyer, as Percy is, which he was wonderful in this role, by the way. You know, if people just know him as Mini-Me from the Austin Powers movie, they really should watch this movie. He was actually a very fine actor.
I do. I'm glad you mentioned Vern Troyer, because I love that his character, he's always given Parnassus shit, which I enjoy, because Parnassus, first of all, I'll tell you how ignorant I was to this film. I thought that Heath Ledger was Dr. Parnassus going in, because I knew nothing of this movie. And then I'm like, oh, wait, Christopher Plummer is Dr. Parnassus. Okay. Like, I, that's how little I knew about this movie. I really thought that that was Heath Ledger was the title character. And even though, Parnassus is ostensibly our protagonist, it's his story from beginning to end. He's kind of hapless in a lot of ways. And he keeps making these deals with the devil, which he's got to know is not going to work. Yeah. And he keeps thinking he's going to try, you know, and I think he was like saying on the level. No, he's not on the level, because he's Satan. Stop. Seriously, he's on the. Stop making these deals. And I like that. I like that. Vern Troyer. I agree. If all you've ever seen him be is Mini-Me, you would enjoy him in this film, because he is. He's kind of the guy steering the ship in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. He's really keeping Parnassus as best he can on the straight and narrow. Because meanwhile, you've got Anton, who clearly has a thing for Valentina. Right. Which can't blame him. And she doesn't really notice. Like, she treats him like a brother, but you could tell there's that scene opening up in the, after they leave the town for the first time, and she talks about that she can't escape because she's got the ankle bracelet, and she puts her leg over, Anton, and it's clearly in a gesture of friends, but you could see the way Andrew Garfield plays it, he gets that look on his face, which I think a lot of us have gotten, where, you know, you're really thinking something very different than probably the woman is understanding. But anyway, yeah, I didn't mean to get too far off track off of Vern Troyer. But in a lot of ways, he's really the guy keeping focus on, you know, getting the train literally kind of moving along, because Parnassus is so dissolute in some places. And part of it is that he's so old. But yeah, no, I think Vern Troyer is great in this movie.
Well, and I think I'd have to watch it again, but I think Vern Troyer is actually one of the monks from the beginning of the movie.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't notice that. Okay.
And he is also one of the only people. He's one of the only people in the movie besides Parnassus who know, and Mr. Nick, who actually knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
No one else really knows. You know, it's secrets upon secrets, and no one really knows what's happening. Except for Percy, you know, and he's the only one who makes sense, because at one point Dr. Parnassus is saying, oh, you know, another wager. I knew it. He can't, Mr. Nick can't help himself. Well, neither can he.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
and Percy keeps telling him, no, not another bet. No, what are you doing? And, you know, and I don't want to sound like a film snob or anything, but the dichotomy of Mr. Nick and Parnassus, you know, they're two sides of the same coin, and which I guess is probably supposed to be the point. And you know, and it is interesting, because he, you know, Mr. Nick is obviously the devil, but Parnassus is supposedly mortal, even though he is immortal now, but he was mortal at one point, I assume. But he is basically in the role of God, you know, because their first bet is to see who can get 12 disciples first. And then the bet after, you know, it's is revealed that Valentina is supposed to be given to Mr. Nick at 16.
Right.
Is who can save five, who can get five souls first.
Right.
You know, and so I'm not quite sure what role Dr. Parnassus plays in the grand scheme of Gilliam's universe here. But it's interesting. It's certainly interesting. And Christopher Plummer, of course, he could have been, you know, reading from the Betty Crocker cookbook, and it would have been fascinating. So
it's amazing to think how long he's been around. I mean, he was in movies in the 50s. for Pete's sakes. And here he is in 2009. And I have to think a lot of these actors are probably doing this movie not for a big paycheck. This movie was budgeted at $30 million, which is shocking to me. It looks way more expensive than that. Mm-hmm. Gilliam must have been pretty good at budgeting. Well, although anybody, I guess, if you're working for Terry Gilliam, you got to be good at budgeting because, good Lord, his ideas probably cost $500 million to put on screen. You got to find a way to do it a little cheaper than that. But everybody in this movie, I have to think, like, somebody as young as Andrew Garfield, because this is him just before Spider-Man, before he really exploded. And, of course, you got Lily Cole, who was not an actress to this point. She was a model. And then sort of dipping into acting. But I mean, imagine being this young, being in your 20s and getting to do scenes with Christopher Plummer.
I know.
You know, like that's just got to be amazing. And I almost think you can almost see the sort of joy on Andrew Garfield's face in his part here, especially when he's dressed up in the silver paint and the mercury helmet and he's running around. And then the same thing for Heath Ledger, who finally he shows up in the film about a half hour in. Where they find him hanging off the bridge with the noose around his neck, and he has that pipe in his throat, which allows him to breathe. Basically, it's a way to trick someone who's hanging you because it thinks that, of course, you've crushed your neck. And I guess the idea is that if you put that in your windpipe can only be crushed so much, so therefore you don't actually choke to death. That's another piece that figures fairly large into the later parts of the movie, but I feel that Gilliam doesn't quite explain all that well. And it was something that I had to learn by looking up the movie on Wikipedia. Was like, oh, that's what that thing is. And that was some of my frustration with this movie at times, is that, as we said, Gilliam blows by ideas so, and this movie's only 2 hours, but it blows by ideas so fast that I think you're just a little like, wait, hold on, what is going on? And then maybe, I guess in some of the best movies, it doesn't matter, I guess. It's almost like a film noir where the plot becomes so complex that you can't follow it anymore. And it doesn't matter. You're just like, all right, I'm just watching this thing unfold. I can't follow it anymore. And that's fine. But yeah, so finally we got Heath Ledger showing up as Tony in his all-white suit and his pencil-thin mustache. And it was sort of funny to me how quickly Tony sort of just – he doesn't even agree to be part of the gang. He just becomes part of the gang. There doesn't even seem to be a lot of argument. I mean, he's an amnesiac. No. He can't remember who he is. But he just all of a sudden just joins the troop, which
I think from one day to the next.
Yeah. In a lot of other movies, the main character, when he's like picked up by this, you know, like a troop, there'd be this whole explanation as to why he decides to be part of this group. But in the Terry Gilliam movie, you just have to accept it. Like Tony just becomes part of this strange group. And we just have to move forward. And then in Terry Gilliam world, that's a perfectly logical thing to do.
Yeah, and I think we're supposed to understand at some point that, and this literally just occurred to me, I think we're supposed to understand that Tony is kind of a grifter anyway,
yes.
which is revealed. And so he sees what Parnassus is doing as a sort of grift. And I think that's why he adapts to it so quickly. But, you know, of course, like in any Terry Gilliam movie, there's this heightened reality going on, because I think it's important to note that this is taking place in current times, right? This is modern London.
Presumably, yeah. The cops are modern dressed, and there's cars and things like that. Yeah,
yeah. You know, when the movie opens, they're in front of a nightclub with people coming out, you know, and all that sort of thing. And but they are riding around in a horse-drawn wagon. That looks like the Jawa transport from Star Wars. and you know, and they're basically dressed like gypsies, and they're very rarely out of costume, you know, or very rarely completely out of costume. Even when they're in so-called normal clothes, they're still kind of wearing the shirt from the night before, or from the, you know, they never completely become a part of reality, until the very end. And I think Tony, you know, because when they first meet Tony, Parnassus is convinced that he was basically put into play by Mr. Nick, which is absolutely true. You know, that is what happened, you know. And you know, and like you said, they find him hanging from underneath a bridge. They think he was trying to commit suicide, which they later find out is not true.
Right.
And you know, and he's an amnesiac, but he pretty quickly finds, he gets his memory back really quickly. And then it's a matter of him hiding his true identity from them for what become obvious reasons. And, but all while all this is going on, they're doing this show that isn't really a show. it's more just Anton talking about how great Dr. Parnassus is.
Yeah, that's not right. It's a show technically, but they don't really do anything other than prance around for a couple of minutes.
Right, and try to get people to walk through the mirror.
Right.
And that's all they do, but there's no like plot. There's no story to their thing. And Tony, once he joins them, he looks at it as a way to make money for the group, but you can tell that he just kind of enjoys tricking people, mm-hmm. taking advantage of people. And even though later on he'll deny that, and he'll deny it almost until the end, but it's pretty obvious from Heath Ledger's acting that he gets a kick out of it.
Mm-hmm.
He's not doing it for any kind of he's not doing it to benefit anyone but himself and his own ego.
Right, he's enjoying the grifting. Even if he's not necessarily benefiting from it, but he's enjoying kind of getting one over on people. There's the scene later on where he's dressed as a harlequin. He's in a clown. He's got that. It looks like a harlequin costume, but with a mask from Eyes Wide Shut. Kind of, he's got this vaguely threatening mask, which makes this the second film in a row for Heath Ledger where he's a menacing clown.
That's true.
This is the way it worked out. But it's interesting that they set up very quickly that he is so much better at getting the women in the crowd into doing what Parnassus wants than Anton, because they meet the two women in the mm-hmm. parking lot in that later scene, and one of them decides they really don't want to get up on stage, but Anton literally grabs her and mm-hmm. picks her up, and she's screaming as he drags her into the mirror, which of course gets the police going. So it's like, that's not the way, that he's reduced to just forcing them to do it. Meanwhile, Tony is a little better at manipulating them enough into doing this. By the way, you mentioned the costumes and the way people are dressed. Every Terry Gilliam, there must be somebody that Terry Gilliam has on staff to dirty up his sets. Like, that's got to be his job. Yeah. Can you think of any Terry Gilliam movie that isn't caked in dirt and filth? Every one of his movies, imagine they build the sets and they build the costumes, and then they have somebody come around with general filth and just rub it and stuff. Because every Terry Gilliam movie, people are in squalor all the time. 12 Monkeys, Time Bandits, this movie, every movie, Brazil. They're mm-hmm. all people in squalor, and that's I think that goes back to Terry Gilliam's kind of weird grim view of nature and stuff. So later on, again, the film moves on and Tony starts finding out more and more about what's going on with Parnassus, and then we get into the film's biggest, I don't know if it's a necessarily biggest leap of audience engagement, I would say, or the biggest ask that the movie is doing, because Tony gets one of the women, one of these shoppers, one of these women from like shopping at like it's a Duke and something. It's supposed to be kind of like Saks Fifth Avenue kind of thing.
Right. Because he convinces them to move the show somewhere else.
Right. And they go, he gets this older woman into the mirror. And when she lifts the mask, Tony is all of a sudden no longer played by Heath Ledger. He's played by Johnny Depp.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole reason for that was, as we mentioned, Heath Ledger unfortunately passed away 1/3 into the filming of this film. And I was reading some stuff about this, and apparently it was Gilliam was working on the film when he got the news, and his first instinct was to say, well, the movie's over. The movie's just over. Mm-hmm. My star has passed away 1/3 into the production. And then they figured out, well, they could rewrite the script in a way that would reshoot all the scenes with Tony inside the Imaginarium, inside the mirror, and rewrite it so that each woman who is in there with Tony sees Tony in the way she wants to see him. And so for this woman, the first woman that goes in, which is in, again, this phantasmagorical world of giant shoes and mm-hmm. necklaces and baubles.
Yeah, she changes for every person. Yeah,
changes for every person. All of a sudden, this woman looks like Johnny Depp. And it was that Johnny Depp and Johnny Depp and Colin Farrell and Jude Law were all friends with Heath Ledger. Right. And they all stepped up and said they will do the movie, not for free, but all of their salaries would be donated to Heath Ledger's young daughter instead of, you know, taking – and they decided and the quote from Colin Farrell was, "We're not finishing Heath's performance. We are simply getting the movie over the finish line," which I thought was an incredibly generous way of putting it. Now, when you saw the movie, how did that work for you? Did you know that was coming? Did you know that you were going to – all of a sudden we were going to be switching actors halfway through?
You know, I didn't. And when I saw it the first time, I guess I was kind of annoyed by it a little bit. I could kind of piece together why it was. I mean, I could just kind of tell myself, okay, well, you know, it's an imaginary space. Because I guess we should kind of attempt to explain that. It's it's kind of an imaginary headspace created by Parnassus going into a trance, but then populated by the people who go through the mirror.
Right.
So everyone kind of sees their own imagination or their own desires given back to them. And again, there's a dichotomy because it is kind of a pure, almost childlike imaginary world. And that is split down the middle by a more base kind of imagination, because like the lady that you're talking about, when Tony becomes Johnny Depp, she starts out in this world of, you know, romance, you know, and, you know, cotton candy clouds and that sort of thing. And Mr. Nick, who somehow invades this space regularly, he offers her the chance to basically go to a hotel literally named the One Night Stand. so you know, it's basically people are given the choice, you know, are like in this case, are you going to choose romance or are you going to choose sex? You know, and everyone is kind of faced with this choice, and that's important to Tony later. But no, I didn't. The first time I saw this movie, I didn't know that was going to happen, and I don't know that it was necessarily successful. But when I saw it again, you know, knowing it was going to happen, and I guess paying more attention, because like you mentioned, the drunk guy from the beginning, his face changes when he goes into the
I bet you they went back and changed that to layer it in early.
I was wondering about that. I don't know if they did or not, or I mean, I assume they did. I mean, why would they do it otherwise? But that kind of gives you something to hook it onto.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it makes more sense. And also it helps that the actors, well, I mean, and I guess this is how Gilliam directed it also, but he is always surprised by the way his face has changed.
Right. Yeah. The first time he looks in the reflection and he's going, oh shit, he's Johnny Depp now.
But you know, if you notice at the end when he is Colin Farrell again, right? I think he sees his face and he's happy to see that face. And I think in a way he's kind of accepting something about himself that is unsavory.
I'd be happy if I saw Colin Farrell in the mirror.
Oh man, right. Are you kidding? And at this point, I'd be happy if I saw Christopher.
My life would have been so much easier.
Oh man, and and so it's a conceit that I don't know necessarily pays off, especially if you're watching it for the first time.
Yes, it's one of these things where. You need to judge the movie as the movie as it exists. Mm-hmm. You know, you judge it or not, or see how it works for you by the movie. You can't, you know, necessarily go and say, well, once I read into it and I learn more about it, then it works. Well, no, it has to work on its own. I didn't feel as though Tony being absent from the film for such large chunks really worked. I just felt like all of a sudden I never really could hook into the idea that this was the same guy.
Right.
Because I couldn't get my mind around the concept of what I knew about the movie. Mm-hmm. Was that, okay, this was a last-minute, jerry-rigged solution to a major problem that they've got. And, you know, by the way, during the Johnny Depp sequence, it's really – I'm almost surprised that this part's still in the movie, or maybe they put it in on purpose in that when the they see the boats come by and there's three boats and they're like little almost funeral pyres for people that died young and therefore stay – young forever because it's Valentino, James Dean, and Princess Diana. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, of course, Heath Ledger is going to be added to that list here. And so, like I said, when I watched it, I was frustrated that Heath Ledger was gone for such large parts of the movie. Now, luckily, they managed to shoot the film in a not out of sequence. So we do get to see Heath Ledger come back in between the sequences. Right. I mean, boy, did that work out for Gilliam, if you could say any part of this movie worked out for him. But, I mean, it really worked out for Gilliam that they managed to shoot all of the sequences in, quote-unquote, reality with Heath Ledger. And that way, Johnny Depp is in the film briefly, he disappears, and now we're back with Heath Ledger. We're reminded, oh, okay, this is his true form.
But
I will say, having him disappear for the film for such large chunks – really, I had a difficult time keeping it together that this was the same guy. But like I said, intellectually, I knew what choice did they have.
Yeah, totally. And that's the thing is that it's hard not to know why they did it. And that reminded me that if Heath Ledger hadn't died, that never would have happened.
Right.
And so it's an interesting solution that never would have been necessary, and if it hadn't been necessary, it never would have been done. And so it's kind of like, well, I see why you did it, but it doesn't add anything to the movie. If anything, it becomes a distraction.
Right. Yeah. I always thought that it's a little similar to what I always thought about like The Simpsons. A lot of people think The Simpsons have like a classic period. And then, you know, maybe not so much after. And I think about like the loss of Phil Hartman when Phil Hartman died and the fact that the film, you know, The Simpsons had to get rid of Troy McClure, you know, and all those great Lionel Hutz and all those great Phil Hartman characters. And you can't help but say, well, yeah, the show is diminished by the loss of these characters and therefore the show isn't as good. But you're like, well, what can they do? You know what I mean? Like the actor is no longer around. So it's like, on the one hand, you're judging it fairly and saying, yeah, the show isn't as good as it used to be. But on the other hand, it's not like they chose for it to be that way. And so when I watched this, I kept, you know, especially since the scene, the space between the scenes of Johnny Depp and Jude Law is like, I think about like 2 minutes. We see Heath Ledger for about 2-3 minutes. By the way, one of the shoppers he's talking to is Gwendolyn Christie in one of her earliest films, the virtually unrecognizable Gwendolyn Christie, but there she is. And then we get into the Jude Law sequence, which is even goofier. I mean, of the three sequences, the Jude Law sequence is almost, to me, the most Monty Python-y of all of them, because you've got the cops dressed like women doing a kick line. You've got the Christopher.
You gotta say what song they're singing.
Well, I forget, what's the song?
The song is, what is it? Join the Fuzz, We Love Violence.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. It says over behind, yeah. And it's all a bunch of, you know, police bobbies, but with high heels and stockings on doing a kick line. That is so, and then we've got the mobsters that run into their mother's hem of her garment because she's giant. And then she pulls her own head off. And Mr. Nick is piloting her like it's the little robot in Men in Black. I'm like, feel like this is everything Terry Gilliam likes in life, is this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and that was like a literal, you know, Deus Ex Machina because it's just, you know, and at that point you kind of feel like he is running out of steam and in terms of, you know, how is he going to wrap this up? Because a lot of the scenes inside the Imaginarium don't add to the movie. You know, they're fun to look at, and they kind of tell you what the stakes are in terms of what Gilliam says the stakes are in, with imagination versus pragmatism, I guess. And but a lot of them go on longer than they need to. And the Jude Law one is, it's a convenient way to get rid of the mobsters. But other than that, it doesn't really serve much purpose.
Yeah, I could see that. So then we get, again, Heath Ledger comes back into the film for his, for another long sequence where he gets into the fight with Anton, and he throws Anton off of the Imaginarium. Andrew Garfield as Anton, dressed as presumably Liz Taylor, in the giant wig. That's just a great.
Image. And I was going to say, the thing that holds those imaginary scenes together for me, you know, with Depp and Jude Law and Colin Farrell, is actually Andrew Garfield. I think he does such a good job of treating these different actors like the same character that really helps kind of bridge the fact that it's not Heath Ledger.
Right. Right. You have to think that some of the stuff without Heath Ledger did get reshot, maybe to strengthen certain things and maybe boost parts. Cause Andrew Garfield's terrific in this movie, and he comes into the film later on in a bigger part than you might expect. So then, when we get to the part with Colin Farrell, they layer that in, earlier by, when Valentina is looking at like her dream life, and she's looking at like an issue of like Ideal Home or something, and she's looking at one of the center spreads, and you see Colin Farrell in like a white suit. And, you know, again, I'm assuming that is something that they layered in later on, is to make him look like Colin Farrell. And then she gets with him in the fantasy world, and they even make love at that point. And then we find out the truth about Tony, about what, that he was actually cheating a charity. Literally, it was like a charity to get organs for children, and he's stealing from them. And there's even, again, there's a bunch of sequences where Valentina starts living the high life at these like society galas and doing all this. And the Tony character actually slaps her around
a little bit,
which is grotesque in the extreme. And again, I got to give Colin Farrell kind of credit for doing that part, because nobody likes to play guys like that. You know, I mean, he belts Valentina a couple of times.
And it's hard to watch. It's that, and the scene of Anton dragging the woman into the mirror are both hard scenes to watch, you know, but I don't know if you could argue that they're necessary. I mean, the one with Tony, I think, is because it's really him showing his true colors. And from there, in another Gilliam kind of trademark move, the whole facade of this imaginary world they're living in starts to fall apart.
Right. And there's this amazing sequence with Valentina. She's running through this mirrored world, and you see the reality around them starts to fracture, and we see pieces of it flying away. And she starts running, and that's when she runs into Mr. Nick, and she decides to give up her own soul voluntarily by throwing herself into the mirror. We haven't really talked about Lily Cole much at all. What do you think of her in this movie? I guess she was relatively inexperienced, but man, I mean, she gets to have scenes with Tom Waits. She gets to have scenes with Andrew Garfield. She gets to have scenes with Christopher Plummer. I mean, how do you think that she handles it? I mean, look, part of it is clearly Terry Gilliam's got a type, because he likes girls with big eyes. He really likes that thing. And Lily Cole is certainly easy on the eyes. I mean, she is, you know, she was a model for Pete's sakes. But how do you think she works as an actress?
I think she holds her own really well. She, like you said, she, you know, is, I mean, you know, she's playing against Christopher Plummer, who is supposed to be her dad. And the chemistry is so easy between the two of them, and so lived in and casual. It is. I mean, and it's not Christopher Plummer is not carrying her at all, you know. And it's. I didn't know that this was her first movie. That's amazing.
I don't know if it's her first, but it's very early.
She
was a model pretty much up until this point, and it's a huge part to give her. You know, I mean, it's not like she's got three lines. She's the female lead of this film.
Yeah. Well, and you sometimes see actors who never get good. You know what I mean? You can always see the artifice. And with her, you know, she is just so much that character that, you know, I think she's fantastic in it, you know, and she, you know, she holds her own with Andrew Garfield, who I, you know, I believe came up from the stage, right? I think he was a stage actor. So. You know, and Heath Ledger, for Christ's sake. So, you know, she is not, she's not on a stage with a bunch of, you know, has-beens and never was. You know, these are people who are, you know, strong actors. And she, you know, it's, if you don't know that this is early in her career, you know, I would have thought that she was maybe a child actor or something. Mm-hmm. She just has such, an ease about her that, yeah, I mean, she's an undeniably beautiful woman. But she kind of, how do I say this without sounding like a masculine jerk? Okay, like Heath Ledger, you know, how he could have become just kind of the handsome man in movies. She could have easily have just been the pretty girl in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But she brings, you know, her character is written this way, but she also brings a performance, I think, that adds more complexity than that.
Right. She could just be the object that the two men are fighting over, and she doesn't mm-hmm. have any agency. But that's not, I mean, for as much as you can have agency in your own life when you're the being pulled between Satan and the immortal Dr. Parnassus, you know, right. He does pretty well for herself. I mean, she makes that choice to go into basically go to hell
mm-hmm.
By her own. I mean, even Mr. Nick even has that line about where he says something like, oh, it's no fun if they pick it themselves. Like, he has to feel like he's got to lure them into it. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought she was good. Again, I have to think that a lot of these actors do these movies because they want to work with Terry Gilliam. Mm-hmm. If this budget was only $30 million, none of them are getting paid a whole lot of money.
Right.
Nobody's getting rich off of doing the imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Well, you know, and just as a quick aside, you had mentioned before also that, you know, that it came in and you know, it not only came in on time, it came in on budget. And, you know, they Gilliam thought that this movie was going to get killed because Heath Ledger was basically how they sold the movie in the first place.
Right, right.
You know, so it's a kind of minor miracle that this movie was made at all.
Yeah, I mean, you could picture them just scuttering, mm-hmm. you know, just saying, forget it. And again, it says something about the relationships that Heath Ledger had with these three Titanic actors that they were willing mm-hmm. to step in. And again, I had read about that that Johnny Depp was just about to go off and shoot some other movie, of course, because he's busy. And Gilliam had him for 1 day and 3 hours.
Really?
That was it. And so they had to get everything in that time. And wow. they managed to do it. And, you know, again, it says something about the friendships that these guys had, that they were willing to do this and drop what they were doing and do this movie essentially for free. And again, I'm sure any Terry Gilliam movie is not an easy shoot because, you know, there's just a lot asked of you, a lot of physicality, a lot of imagining, you know, okay, you're going to climb up this ladder into the sky, Jude. Imagine what that looks like. All right. And then these guys are going to run into this woman and her head's going to come off. And, you know, I mean, it's like, it's not just standing there, you know, just reciting, you know, boring lines back and forth in a room. You know, there's a lot going on here.
Right. You know, and just as a quick aside, that was one thing that kind of bothered me about this movie also, was I missed Gilliam's old school animation and mm-hmm. the practical effects. There's a lot of CGI in this.
There's a lot of CGI, yeah.
And I don't think it works. I think it looks so, this is going to sound weird to say about Gilliam's style, but it looks so cartoony.
It looks plastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Plastic, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's perfect. And it just didn't work. You could kind of see echoes of Gilliam's style in it, but it didn't have any of his artistry, I guess.
I could see. Right. It doesn't, there's no like edges to it. Mm-hmm. A little bit, which I think in a weird way gives it a little more verisimilitude. You can sort of see the dirty edges in some weird way as something looks a little too clean, mm-hmm. a little too perfect. And we talked about the end of this movie with Colin Farrell. The unfortunate part is Colin Farrell wraps up Tony's character because we don't get Heath Ledger again after this. And so the film concludes essentially with Colin Farrell's character as Tony 3. And that to me is the part where you're like, oh man, I really wish they had been able to, again, can't blame Gilliam. It's not his fault. But I really wish for the coherency of the film, I really wish they had managed to get some footage of Heath Ledger coming back one last time. And we see him as Tony one last time before we get the final scene with Parnassus and Percy and him seeing what's happened to Valentina and how she has found love with Anton. Spoiler alert, by the way. Right. But that to me was the biggest one, was that, shoot, the movie ends not with Heath Ledger. And that's a darn shame, because you really wish they had been able to do that. But again, what can you do? That was the unfortunate. So it's a patch job. It's a pretty good patch job as things go. And luckily, so the film begins with Parnassus and ends with Parnassus. And it has a great, I love Mr. Nick tempting the nuns with the apple. That's just fantastic.
I made a note of that.
Oh, my God. That's great. He's just, you know, and again, like you're talking about, he doesn't force anybody into this. They do this willingly, because he just leans forward and hands the apple, and the one nun is like, like, don't fall for it, sister. And then it ends with friggin' Parnassus getting distracted again, and it's up to Percy to slap him and be like, get back to work. So it's like, even through all this, Parnassus still hasn't quite learned. Nope. Just stay away from Mr. Nick. Just stop trying. Stop being distracted. Stop being tempted by this guy.
Well, and so, it's like you said, it's interesting, because at one point, after Valentina gives herself up and seems to commit herself to hell, which I guess is the real world,
agreed.
Yeah, agreed. I know. Maybe I think Gilliam was onto something. Parnassus is on, in one of his, on a cliff in his imaginarium. And, Mr. Nick says to himself, damn, I won. You know, because I think for Mr. Nick, it's about the game, not about winning or losing. You know, it's about keeping this going. And Parnassus is just as susceptible to this as Mr. Nick is, which is I think why Mr. Nick likes continuing this with Parnassus so much, is because he's basically his immortal nemesis. And he seems to wander that imaginary, because his imaginarium basically goes fallow. You know, it's all desert and ruins, and while he's searching for Valentina. And in the real world, he is becoming basically homeless.
Right, he becomes this sort of filthy old man wandering the streets, and people are ignoring him or pretending like they don't see him, because he looks like a homeless person.
Right. And Valentina drops a coin in his hat the same way her mother did when Parnassus first met her.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that, but you're right.
Yeah. And that's how he finds Valentina again, but he leaves her alone.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
he sees her through the plate glass and sees that she's happy.
Right. Exactly. She said she's apparently married to Anton now, and they have a child, and he leaves her, which is probably, he's been searching for her all this time, but it's enough for him to know that she is happy.
Yeah.
And, and it's a nice little ending, and, he's back with Percy, and they're selling little, cutout puppets, on the street. And, he's cleaned himself up by this point. And, Percy's still giving him hell and keeping him on the straight and narrow.
Giving him
hell. And that's when we see Mr. Nick again, with the apple and the nun and, trying to just, and that's how the movie ends. And, I wish we had gotten more Heath. Let me ask you this. What would you think would have been better? Finishing the movie and getting what we got, or not finishing the movie at all?
Oh, always finish it. I think always finish it. I think once you've shot I would say a flawed film is better than no film at all, I would argue. I mean, maybe if you're Brett Ratner, don't finish your movie, because who cares? But I mean, Terry Gilliam, it's worth it. So yeah, I would say even this is, it was nice that we got this final performance from Heath Ledger, even if it is an incomplete I'd still say it was worth it. And so, yeah, I would say go ahead. And again, you know, an amazingly, not many filmmakers and not many actors would be able to be in this position that you can get last minute replacements by three of the biggest movie stars working mm-hmm. at the time. This is sort yeah. of remarkable. Yeah. It's sort of funny. It makes me think about like how I mentioned one of Heath Ledger's, the last film Heath Ledger was in that was released in his lifetime was I'm Not There, where I mentioned he played Bob Dylan along with five other actors, including Cate Blanchett, playing my favorite Bob Dylan in that movie, by the way, is the mod 60s Bob Dylan. It would have been interesting if one of the Tonys was a woman yeah. in the Imaginarium. They could have done that too.
You know, that actually would have been a really great idea. That yeah. would have been a great idea.
I mean, again, it was all who was available at the time, and I'm sure that it was very easy to help finish the marketing of this film, saying, well, not only do we have Heath Ledger, we've got Johnny Depp and Jude Law and Colin Farrell. And you mentioned the ending of the film. It ends on the paper Nickelodeon or the little puppet stage that mm-hmm. Parnassus is selling. And it ends on, credit-wise, a very, I think, charming grace note from Terry Gilliam, where it ends, the first credit we see, it says, a film from Heath Ledger and friends, which I thought was a very classy way of giving a nice tribute to his fallen star. And then it ends with directed by Terry Gilliam. But I just thought that was very sweet that's, you know, how it's going to go out is that this is, you know, a film from Heath Ledger. Right. I thought that was really quite charming and a nice thing for Terry Gilliam to do.
I think so too. And there was one of the last lines of the movie is from Percy, from Vern Troyer. And I'm sure it was in the script to begin with, because, you know, the whole thing is about stories and storytelling and imagination. And, you know, when they are, you know, Parnassus is demonstrating the puppets, you know, he's basically telling his own story. And a kid comes up to Percy and asks him, does it come with a happy ending? And Percy tells him, sorry, we can't guarantee that. And I thought, what a great line. Mm-hmm. What a great line. Because that right there, I think, is what Gilliam's whole point is. You know, that we are all telling our own stories. And we can't guarantee what the ending is going to be. But we keep telling our story.
It reminds me of a quote from Orson Welles where someone said, does your story have a happy ending? And he says, well, it depends where you end it. That's a great, great way of putting it. So, yeah, in regards to Heath Ledger, I mean, his last completed film was, of course, The Dark Knight, which mm-hmm. he won a posthumous Oscar for. And, you know, I will say, not again, we're here to talk about Imaginarium, but I will throw this in about The Dark Knight. I remembered when I heard that he was cast as the Joker, my first instinct was, what? Mm-hmm. You know, what? We Will Rock You guy? That guy? You know, I mean, come on. I had not seen Brokeback Mountain or anything. I don't think I'd seen Heath Ledger in maybe anything at that point. But I was like, well, I really like Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. So I trust Christopher Nolan. If he thinks this is the right guy, okay. But I will say I was skeptical. Now, unlike a lot of nerds, I didn't go to the internet to complain. I just kind of shrugged my shoulders and went on with my day.
You didn't burn the internet down?
I did not burn the internet down. But I will say, and this is hardly a hot take, I mean, good Lord, did Heath Ledger crush the living hell mm-hmm. out of that part. I think it took me, I don't know, maybe a minute and a half into his first scene. And I just went, oh, yeah, he's the Joker. That's it. Yeah. He got it. This guy, this movie star, this really handsome young movie star has made himself look like a bedraggled, oily, creepy live wire. And I am here for it. And I will always, aside from the tragedy of anyone dying at 28 and dying sort of the way he did and leaving a family behind and all of it is horrible. Just to think of what performances might have come from him mm-hmm. as he got older, because I just thought he was just so amazing in The Dark Knight that, and again, as we talked about at the top of the show, who he chose to work with as a young actor, he could have really just done a lot of cheesy stuff, but who, you know, he's choosing to work with Ang Lee and Christopher Nolan and Terry Gilliam, interesting filmmakers. And mm-hmm. the guy probably would have had an amazing career. And it's a damn shame that it got cut short the way that it did. But at least we have the films that we have. And like I said, if you're going to go out on a Terry Gilliam movie, even a half kind of finished Terry Gilliam movie, there are probably worse ways. Because, again, he's one of our most, you know, like, renowned and interesting filmmakers, even though his films a lot of times seem to be cursed.
Oh my God. don't say the Don Quixote word.
Oh man. I mean, good Lord. When I think of Terry, not to get too off the subject, but when I think of Terry Gilliam's movies, I mean, a lot of the stuff that happens to him isn't his fault. Mm-hmm. You know, Heath Ledger passing away, that was not his fault. And some of the other things that happened. But at the same time, I think of this line that I heard from in I, Claudius, where Augustus Caesar is talking to one of his daughters, I think Julia, who has been widowed twice before mm-hmm. she's 30. And he says, he complains to her about it. And she's like, and that's my fault? And he's like, how any woman finds herself widowed twice before she's 30 is beyond me. Like, he's almost kind of blaming her for it. And it's like, I can't blame Terry Gilliam for all the trouble that's befallen him. But at the same time, you're like, is this guy just cursed? Because so much bad stuff happens to him when he makes his movies. It just seems
I
have to think that when the insurance agents are putting together their actuarial tables for Terry Gilliam's movies, they're just like, all right, what's going to happen? Is the set going to blow up? Is there going to be maybe some sort of like horrible pandemic that hits? I don't know. What's going to happen? I mean, mm-hmm. it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, no, and I don't, you know, I'd have to look at the IMDb, but I don't think has he made another movie since this one? I know he's done some stage stuff and like an opera and some commercial work, but I don't, has he actually made a full-length movie?
I don't believe so. I think he's, I know, the Don Quixote movie, was it ever really finished? I'm feeling ignorant. I mean, he's credited, he did do a movie called The Zero Theorem. In 2013, which I have not seen. That's with Christoph Waltz. I have not seen that one. Mm. And he is credited with the man who killed Don Quixote. And mm-hmm. again, I have not seen that film. But that was 2018. It's got Adam Driver in it. Again, another actor who's done a lot of interesting projects early on. But so 2018 was the last film, so it's not that long, you know. I mean, it's not too bad for him. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah. I just want to echo what you were saying too. I was thinking about this yesterday because I watched the movie again last night, and you know, it's hard not to look at Heath Ledger and think, you know, what roles would he have gotten that other actors got since he died, and you kind of think, oh, he would have been so good in this, or he would have been great in that, mm-hmm. and like you said, it's a tragedy. You know, tragedy is you know, unfulfilled potential, and. There was so much unfulfilled potential with Heath Ledger, and it's a shame. It is just a shame. I'm glad we got the performances from him that we have. And like you said, his Joker is, I can't even think of his Joker and think of Heath Ledger because they're just so, he is so into that character. You can't even see Heath Ledger in there anymore. And, it's just a shame that we didn't get more movies from him.
When I saw Heath Ledger as Joker walking around in that nurse's outfit,
oh my God,
I just said, this is an actor completely free of like ego and mm-hmm. worrying about what he looks like. Cause he just, I just couldn't believe I was seeing that in a Batman movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just unbelievable. So he was a tremendous actor and I said a huge loss. And like I said, it was fun getting a chance to watch the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. I mean, again, I've liked Terry Gilliam's movies. They're always interesting, even when they don't totally work. They're always interesting, and yeah. I'm glad we had a chance to. I had a reason to watch this movie and catch up with it and get to see Heath Ledger's final performance. So, Max, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. It was great talking about this movie with you.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm always up for talking movies, and especially with you. You know, it's always a lot of fun, and always. You know, I always walk away from our conversations appreciating the movies we watch a little more.
Especially Alucarda, but that's
Alucarda.
Our favorite film we've seen together, Alucarda.
Oh my God.
So why don't you, that was over at Film and Water, everybody. You got to check that one out. So,
Because now we're going to spend another hour talking about Alucarda.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We got to do. Yeah. Coming soon. Alucarda minute. So why don't you tell people where they can find you here on our network?
They can find me at, Sorry, I fuzzed out for a second there. You can find me here on Plasticast and also the Mirror Factory.
All right, excellent. And I suggest to everyone to follow the shows. They're very highly entertaining. Of course, you can follow this show on our website. All the back episodes are on fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Fade Out Pod. And finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So again, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. So that's it. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks for the next episode. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.